You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Claire Balderson with NewsHour, and we begin today with something of a mystery. The apparent reappearance in Washington of an Iranian nuclear scientist who went missing while on the Hajj in Saudi Arabia last year. Where Shahram Amiri has been for the past few months and why he's turned up now at the Iranian interest section of the Pakistani embassy is not at all clear. Videos posted on YouTube have made the whole story even murkier. The first, initially broadcast by Iranian television early last month, showed a man resembling Mr. Amiri saying that he'd been kidnapped by the US while on pilgrimage and that he was now living in Arizona. The man says, "My name is Shahram Amiri. I am in Tucson in the United States, caught up in an operation between the US and Saudi Arabia." He goes on to say that he'd been injected with something in Saudi Arabia that had rendered him unconscious. He was transferred to the US, and he says he was put under pressure through torture there. Well, the Iranian government described the video as evidence that Shahram Amiri was being held in the US against his will. But just hours later, another video surfaced, again posted on YouTube.
ضمن عرض سلام و تشکر از فرصتی که به من داده شد تا بتوانم با جامعه جهانی به صورت مستقیم صحبتی داشته باشم.
Well, this was a similar-looking man, again claiming to be Shahram Amiri, but saying this time that he was happy to be in the US and was living in freedom and safety. Nothing more was heard immediately until a third video surfaced a couple of weeks later.
I, Shahram Amiri, am a national of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and minutes ago I was able to escape American security agents in the state of Virginia, and presently I'm producing this video in a safe place. In a few minutes' time, I might be arrested again by the American security agents. In this brief period, I would like to speak about the two videos that were published by myself. The first video, which was published by the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, where I spoke to my compatriots from the city called Pusan, is completely authentic and there are no fabrications in it. However, the second video, which was published on YouTube by the American government, where I have said that I am free and want to continue my education here, is not true and is a complete fabrication. I am not free here and I am not permitted to contact my family. Should there be any problems caused for me or if I do not return to my homeland alive, the direct responsibility for that is with the government of the United States of America.
Well, that then is the somewhat contradictory tale that was emerging in June. Now come these reports that Mr. Amiri is in the Iranian interest section of the Pakistani embassy in Washington. Tehran doesn't have formal diplomatic relations with the US, so its interests are handled by Pakistan. Abdul Basit is spokesman for the Pakistani Foreign Ministry in Islamabad.
We got in touch with the head of the Iranian interest section in Washington, Dr. Mustafa Rehmani. And what we have been told by him is that Dr. Shahram Amiri reported, or I do not know how it happened, but he is there since yesterday. And now what we understand from them is that they are making arrangements to repatriate this gentleman to Iran. This is what all we have from the Iranian interest section.
Do you have any idea of how he comes to be there?
No, we would not know about that, unfortunately.
Will you be asking them, trying to get more information from them?
The government of Iran would know about this. We would not have any knowledge or information as to how he ended up there at the Iranian section.
And
the U.S. government itself would know about it. We would not have any information.
And if they want to repatriate him, do you get involved at that stage?
If so required, we will. But obviously, we will see how things evolve. But at this point in time, as I said earlier, we have not been asked by either side to facilitate, or the Iranian interest section would be making arrangements for his repatriation.
That's as long as he wants to go.
Yeah, as far as if there are any communications or any correspondence, obviously, if required, the Pakistan embassy would do the needful, as we have been doing in the past as well.
That was Abdel Basset, spokesman for the Pakistani Foreign Ministry in Islamabad. Well, John Lyne is our Tehran correspondent. He is currently in Cairo. Who is Shahram Amiri?
Even that's not very clear. The Americans haven't really spoken on the record about him, but they've hinted that he's a pretty well knowledgeable nuclear scientist in the Iranian nuclear program. They've been getting good information off him.
They say then that they have been talking to him for this past year since he disappeared.
Well, they've not said it on the record, but they have given the information. American sources have given the information to American media, particularly ABC News.
There were those reports that he had, in fact, defected. Was there evidence for that?
Well, only the evidence that the Americans gave to American media organizations. He's never been produced publicly by them. And, of course, all the time along, Iran's always said that he'd been kidnapped by the Saudis originally in Saudi Arabia and then handed over to the Americans.
And it is all a bit strange because you had those videos that were very contradictory about what had happened to him. Now he's apparently turning up at the Iranian interest section of the Pakistani embassy. What's going on?
To my mind, there's two possible scenarios here. Either the Iranians are telling the truth, which is that he was kidnapped and that he's escaped American sort of custody or American control, or possibly they managed to put pressure on him after he defected. I gather his wife and child or children are back in Iran, so they would have leverage over him, and they certainly know how to put pressure on exiles, as I've found to my experience quite a lot around the world, and maybe they've lent on him to come back into their control, into their custody.
Is it possible, as is being suggested in some of the American papers today, that Iran might want to use him in some kind of a swap for people that perhaps they're holding? Some of the newspapers are talking about those American hikers who were detained in Iran, that may be what this is about, a trade of some sort.
Certainly possible. I mean, they've been holding these three American hikers since last summer. I think it was August or July. They were captured on the border between Iran and Iraq. So America has kind of hinted that they want to do a deal, but they haven't really hinted who they want to do the deal about. So that's one possibility. I mean, of course, Shahram Amiri, he can't be taken out of the Iranian diplomatic mission by the Americans, but he can't leave either without their permission. He can't go to the airport unless the United States agrees. And one would think Washington might want a price for that, or they would certainly want convincing that he's there of his own free will.
So what do you think is going to happen to him now? There's going to have to be an awful lot of sort of diplomatic wrangling, presumably through the Pakistanis.
At the very least, wrangling, possibly a diplomatic standoff if the Iranians demand that he be allowed to leave the embassy and go home. The Pakistanis are in a funny position, really, because they're, of course, American allies, but they're friends with the Iranians as well. That's why they're the protecting power. They look after Iranian diplomatic interests in the United States. So I suppose they're as good a mediator as anybody.
That's the BBC's John Lyne speaking to me from Cairo. Lots of you have been commenting in emails sent to the BBC on this story. Ruhollah, for example, in the US, says it's obvious that Mr. Shahram Amiri's family are under arrest in Iran. Amiri has been forced to surface and give himself up to save their lives. That's what he thinks. But Daniel says, I don't believe anyone's account. He's emailing us from San Diego. I certainly cannot trust either regime. I can't trust that anyone claiming to be Shahram Amiri is truly him, whether presented by either regime or otherwise. And Kian in Los Angeles says, I'm an Iranian citizen and student living here in LA. I think if he's seeking help at Iran's interest section in Washington, then we must give credit to the third video. That's that whole complicated thing about the videos. However, it is complicated, he says. Yes, indeed it is. What is suspicious is his face, which is abnormal and full of stress in the second video. World, have your say at bbc.com for your thoughts on this or any other story. The lower house of the French Parliament is voting today on legislation to ban women from wearing full face veils in public. The Senate will vote on the measure in September. President Nicolas Sarkozy supports the bill as part of a wider debate on national identity. But critics say the government's pandering to far-right voters by taking aim at a tiny minority of Muslim women. Interior Ministry figures estimate fewer than 2,000 women in France wear the full veil, or niqab, often referred to locally as the burqa. From Paris, our correspondent Christian Fraser reports.
In the words of the French Prime Minister, the burqa is a dark, sectarian image of Islam. But to 35-year-old Christelle Kadrouche, it is her decision to wear it, and hers alone, dictated by her faith. And she will wear it, whatever bill the French Parliament approves.
For me, it's not that l'identité nationale.
For me, that's not national identity. It's not about how you dress. We're not robots. For instance, when I watch a football match, my heart supports France. That's what being French means. If I watch the Olympics, I'm cheering for France because I'm French. When France does something good, I'm happy and proud. But when I see this debate, I'm very unhappy. Being French, national identity is feeling at one with your country.
Christelle is one of barely 2,000 women who wear the burqa in France. Like the majority, she converted 11 years ago. She's married to an Algerian Muslim with whom she has 5 children. Under the proposed legislation, a simple shopping trip could next year lead to her arrest. She'd be escorted home, ordered to remove the burqa and fined 150 euros. There are far harsher penalties for male family members found to be enforcing the veil, including a year in jail. It's a bill that has the support of over 70% of the French public.
I think it is going beyond tolerance because they're trying to impose their lifestyle, and we have another conception of how a woman can behave in the streets.
We are in a modern world, a modern country, so in fact we must be free to show our faces.
If they want to go out in the street like that, it's their problem, not mine. But I don't like it generally.
But the bill has been carefully crafted to avoid singling out Muslims. Officially, it's called the Bill to Forbid Covering One's Face in Public. In all likelihood, it will pass, at least through the lower house. The socialist opposition have relented under pressure from their own feminist lobby and will now abstain. The Justice Minister, Michel Alliot-Marie, says there is no place for a partial ban.
Democracy functions with its face uncovered. It functions through respect for women and their dignity. It functions through respect for the equality between men and women.
The Muslim Council of France also disliked the veil. For them, it has no place in Islam. But nor do they like the bill for its perceived targeting of a Muslim community that already feels stigmatized. Dalil Boubakar is director of the Grand Mosque in Paris.
There is no valid reason why they are doing this, forcing these kinds of restrictions on people, this kind of repression.
Meanwhile, police unions, whose members will be asked to enforce any new law, say they also have concerns about how they go about that. Pascal Disson from the Police Union Alliance says his members don't warm to the idea of apprehending women in the street and escorting them home before demanding they reveal their face.
Honestly, I think there are more pressing issues at the moment, more important things than, excuse me for saying this, the hunt for the burqa.
President Sarkozy says a new law would reinforce French secular values. But European human rights lawyers suggest you can no more prevent a woman from wearing the Islamic veil than you can someone wearing a crash helmet or even a skiing balaclava. And what happens when a woman inevitably challenges this law when she's arrested in the highest courts of Europe?
That was Christian Fraser reporting from Paris on the burqa debate in France. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up later in the programme, several countries bordering Uganda have issued security alerts following Sunday's bombings in Kampala. Officials say they're worried that conflict in Somalia could spill across their borders. We hear from the Inspector General of the Ugandan Police on why Africans need to stay united against Somalia's militant Islamist Al-Shabaab.
Africa is united against it. We are not there as Uganda. We are there as AMISOM, as African troops, because it's a threat to African peace and security. Linked to the global problem of Al-Qaeda. So we must stabilize Somalia. We cannot have a failed state in our neighborhood and we think we are secure.
More of that interview later on. First, a reminder of the other main stories in the news. Pakistan's announced that a missing Iranian nuclear scientist, who Tehran says was kidnapped by the CIA, has turned up at the Iranian interest section of Pakistan's embassy in Washington. And President Karzai of Afghanistan has apologized to Britain after 3 troops were killed by an Afghan soldier. You're listening to NewsHour with Claire Balderson. Police in Italy have arrested around 300 people and seized tens of millions of dollars worth of assets, arms and drugs as part of a major anti-mafia operation. About 3,000 officers were involved in a series of dawn raids targeting the Calabrian mafia known as 'Ndrangheta. Mariella Tanzarella is a journalist with La Repubblica newspaper in Milan. She says the arrests were countrywide.
Nearly half of them were in the north of Italy because, you know, the north is the wealthy part of the nation, so here is where the money goes around.
And what were they doing there, allegedly?
Well, mainly the astonishing thing is that there were a few arrests in the area of the healthcare, which means that they are very, you know, interested in the fact that there is a lot of money going around in healthcare sector, and also this means that there was already some corruption there, because they are trying to get in touch with the politicians who already put their hands on the healthcare sector.
They're using the healthcare, how? I mean, how's that connected, healthcare industry, to the mafia?
If they can manipulate the politician who, in their turn, manipulate the healthcare business, you know, the business is very big, so they get money. In the end, that's a question.
That seems rather extraordinary. How big a blow is it to the mafia, then, that this number of people...
It's a huge blow, because it hasn't... Well, this is the first time that the biggest one, I would say the worst blow in the last at least 16 years, but some say even 30 years, because they really arrested one big boss in Calabria and many quite important ones in the rest of the country.
There are reports that it was related to, this operation against them was related to an internal dispute that had been going on. Can you tell us anything about that between the South and the North?
Yeah, right, exactly. They were trying to, the North wanted to, let's say, emancipate, because they felt, and it's true, that they were the ones who moved the money. So they wanted to become more autonomous. So were trying to do.
So have they actually been fighting amongst themselves, the North and the South?
Yeah. There was a lot of fighting among them as well.
And what has been learned about the actual structure of the mafia? Because the police are saying that it's a different organisation to the one they thought.
Yeah, true. And if you see, we were, La Repubblica was the first newspaper who got a frame of a video. It was the first time in the history of mafia that we had such a kind of image, where you can see the mafiosi people rising their hands to vote to elect their boss just outside Milan, a local boss, which means that their structure is vertical. So they have a cupola, they have a top management, you look like the Cosa Nostra, like the Sicilian mafia. So, and we thought before that it was different organization, that they were like, you know, everybody just, the local groups just organized themselves how they wanted, but this is not true. So there is a very important structure.
That's Mariella Tanzarella of La Repubblica newspaper in Milan. Well, that is the sound of B6, a young DJ and record producer from China. We often talk about the rise of China economically, but what about culturally? What's it like being an artist or involved in culture or music or anything in China? Well, B6, who's from Shanghai, and Abe, a guitarist from the Beijing indie rock group Bigger Bang and the Band, have been speaking to the BBC's Lawrence Pollard.
The thing that interests me is I'm using all these Western terms of reference. You know, I'm kind of saying, oh, that reminds me a bit of this band that I remember from the West, or this band that I remember from the West. But you guys are Chinese. Yeah. So, you know, are you mixing? Are you adopting? What are you doing with Western influences to make them Chinese?
I don't like the Chinese mainstream music. It's not because we have a lot of good musicians. It's like B6 in China now. And we are so proud of that, yeah.
Well, listen, let's listen to a bit of B6. I'm going to ask you, B6, to talk us through this track, but let's hear a little bit first. B6, I've got to say, everyone here in the studio was kind of nodding their heads in a really relaxed way, like the sun's just coming up at 5 a.m. in Ibiza. But that's very beautiful, very ethereal, electronica, house, acid. How do you describe that? What are the influences that brought you to your style there?
Honestly, most of the influence come from the German techno, minimal techno scene. Things like 2000s, I was getting involved with the party scene here. So most of the people working in the party scene are European people.
That sounds
you know, sort of, you could almost call it an international style of electronic music, couldn't you? Is there anything specifically Chinese, do you think, about your take on that style?
I think the Chinese thing is in my soul and the blood and the bone. You know, it's not like you put a Chinese flute or a Chinese, like, tradition instrument on it. I just do the Western music, but I'm Chinese, so it's Chinese music.
This business of the lifestyle that goes with rock and roll. Yeah. You know the kind of thing I'm talking about, the bottle of Jack Daniels, the bad behaviour, the throwing televisions out of hotel windows. Does Chinese rock and roll do that, like Western rock and roll does? Is there a kind of a dissolute, drug-taking, bad-behaving outlaw element to the music?
Yeah, absolutely. Some part of my members in the band, they're really like, you know, the Jack Daniels, like alcohols and the liquors.
Do you think that China will become slowly a cultural superpower in the way that the US has been? B6, what do you think?
Yes, I do, but slowly. I think it's going to be really slow, because this kind of culture needs to be like a family tree. You have to have like the history of the music culture. But China, as we all know, because of the Cultural Revolution, the history, the family tree is cut. We have like 30 years empty year, totally empty, no culture at all. It's very hard to build up in this time.
Do you think that political developments in China mm-hmm. are important when you think about cultural developments?
Of course, of course.
Because, of course, culture, we always think of creative artists as about freedom of expression. Isn't it?
Yes, yes, it's true. It always been a very big issue in China.
And what is the role of the artist when you're looking at discussions in society about freedom of speech?
It doesn't make a very big problem for the music scene. For other things like film business, yeah. It's a very big issue. I think China will keep this politic for a long time. We can make it better, but we cannot totally change it.
That's Abe and B6 from China talking to Lawrence Pollard. Don't forget that if you want to listen to the programme at any other time, not directly on air, you can download it for free by going to our website, bbcworldservice.com/newshour, and click where it says NewsHour Podcast. That's what you'll get in NewsHour Podcast. Or go directly to our Facebook page, BBC NewsHour, and you'll also find the podcast there. There'll be a link to our latest programme. Let's go back to China. Here's a bit of No Hero Days by Bigger Bang and the Band. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Claire Balderson with NewsHour. The Ugandan authorities investigating Sunday night's double bombings that killed more than 70 people say they found an unexploded suicide belt at a dance hall in Kampala. The Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab has said it was behind the explosions, which happened as people watched the World Cup football final. Uganda is one of the main contributors to the African Union force in Somalia and had been threatened by Al-Shabaab before the bombings. Our correspondent Will Ross is in the Ugandan capital Kampala, where this morning he attended a police news conference.
It was an interesting press conference, the packed press conference that the Inspector General of Police and some of his colleagues gave. That's Kali Kaihura. He displayed a number of items that the police say were picked up at a discotheque on Monday after a tip-off from a member of the public. Now, these items included explosives, a detonator, a package of densely packed ball bearings, presumably to give the device extra impact. There was a canvas jacket, which the police said was to be used by a suicide bomber. Now, all of these items were in a black laptop bag, which was found in this discotheque. Now, the police are saying there could be a link between that finding and the two attacks on Sunday, which we now know killed at least 76 people. The police also said, despite the fact that Al-Shabaab, the Somali Islamist group, has said that it carried out the attacks, the Ugandan police are saying that there's also a link to the ADF, the Allied Defence Forces, which is a rebel group that's been operating out of Western Uganda for some time. And after the press conference, I had a chance to speak to Kali Kahura, the Inspector General of Police, and I put it to him that given how difficult it is to detect these kind of explosive devices that could be hidden in baggage, I asked him what can be done about the safety.
You know, this is a discotheque. That means there is laxity. Yesterday I issued a security alert and urged all the proprietors of these places to take basic access control measures, which we had, by the way, put in place.
But anybody walking along the street with a bag on their back might be a suicide bomber if that is so easy to hide.
Yeah, that's why we're saying anybody suspicious, please look out for them, inform. In other words, it's vigilance. And we have used this before. We used it when we had that wave of attacks, of bombings in the 90s, and it worked. Those can easily be detected.
Some will say, Inspector General, that had the Ugandan troops not gone into Somalia, we wouldn't now be experiencing this here.
Well, that is not necessarily so.
Well, Al-Shabaab says so.
In any event, let me tell you, if you tolerate a group like Al-Shabaab to take over power in our neighborhood, that's why Africa is united against Al-Shabaab. Because, you see, they start there and they want to spread that ideology. They call it international jihad or something.
But some will say it has spread, and it's spread right here to Kampala.
No, excuse me. It would be worse if they're in charge of state power. You get it? And that's why Africa is united against it. We are not there as Uganda. We are there as AMISOM, as African troops. You get it? Because it's a threat to African peace and security. It's linked to the global problem of Al-Qaeda.
Is the problem then that too many of the AU troops are Ugandan, and that's the key to the problem? If there were troops from all over the continent, maybe Al-Qaeda wouldn't be targeting Uganda specifically.
I don't know, because they're also targeting Burundi. So anybody who contributes troops will be their target. In any event, you see, we're not doing just a charitable job. We have a self-interest. The security of Somalia. Somalia is in our neighborhood. You see a lot of guns in Karamoja. Guns come all the way from Yemen, through Somalia, through Kenya, into Karamoja. The gun running actually goes up to southern Sudan. So we must stabilize Somalia. We cannot have a failed state in our neighborhood and we think we are secure. Your security is really tied to the security of your neighbor. That's why we talk about neighborhood watch. I'm actually pushing that line at local level, but even at state level or even international level. You cannot think you're going to be peaceful if your neighborhood is not.
But also, isn't it true, your AU troops are using force against the militants in Somalia? They're responding now, they say, with these kinds of attacks. You can't use force against this kind of problem.
In fact, I have been very measured. Our peacekeeping forces, I'm not the most qualified to talk about it because I'm in the police. The CDF will talk about it better. But from what I know, our peacekeeping forces have operated within their mandate. They only attack in self-defense when they are attacked. They are using force within the limited mandate that they have. Otherwise, if it was not so limited, oh God, the whole of Mogadishu would be under the transitional government. But
is that what's needed then, a more forceful mandate?
That's not me to say, please. That's not ask those who are responsible. Mine is internal security of Uganda.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was our correspondent Will Ross speaking to Kali Kayahura, the Inspector General of the Ugandan Police. And let's talk a bit more now about the African Union mission in Somalia. It's about 5,000 strong and it's in Somalia to support the transitional government in its struggle against the Islamist militants, including Al-Shabaab. Roger Middleton is from the Africa Programme at the international affairs think tank Chatham House here in London. There are opposition politicians in Uganda who want to pull their troops out of Somalia. Is that likely?
I think that's very unlikely. The Ugandan government's already gone on record and said they won't be pulling out of Mogadishu after these terrible bombings. You know, and it's worth bearing in mind that the only thing that is standing between really the collapse, the complete collapse and disappearance of the internationally recognised transitional government in Somalia and Al-Shabaab is that Amisom force, predominantly Ugandan with some Burundian elements as well.
Is it not possible, though, that other countries will be put off sending troops to it? Because the AU says that it needs more, doesn't it?
It's about half the strength it's supposed to be. I think it's supposed to be at about 8,000 troops, and clearly more would be needed if you were really serious about taking control of Mogadishu and surrounding areas. In the past, countries like Nigeria and others have said that they have troops ready to go and to join this AU mission, even that they've been at the airport waiting to leave, but they've never materialized. And I think it's been very understandable, this reluctance to send troops to Somalia. After all, this is supposed to be a peacekeeping mission, but actually, in reality, this is much more about being in between the insurgents and the government. So it's not really peacekeeping so much as, you know, right in the middle of a hot war.
What is their mandate?
Their mandate is to protect humanitarian services, and for that they protect delivery of aid at the port and at the airport, and to protect the transitional federal government. But they don't have a mandate to take offensive measures against insurgents and impose peace.
But there have been accusations, particularly against Ugandans, that they stay outside Mogadishu for the most part in relative safety and lob shells into Mogadishu. This is what some civilians say, and some of the Al-Shabaab people say, and that they kill an awful lot of civilians in the process.
There have certainly been allegations of that. I mean, the Ugandans were countered by saying that they've been attacked from residential areas, and then when they've responded, the insurgents who have attacked them have just melted away, and there have been civilian casualties. And I think it illustrates how incredibly difficult it is for any military force, but particularly a foreign peacekeeping force, to carry out its duties in somewhere like Mogadishu. It's very hard, if not impossible, to avoid civilian casualties. And that's not to say it's okay to have civilian casualties, but it is a very difficult mission that they have.
Well, then one wonders what the point is, given that they are trying to police Mogadishu, but already Al-Shabaab and other militant groups have control of parts of the capital and large parts of the country, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they control most, its opposition groups control most of Mogadishu, as well as the vast majority of south-central Somalia. So you might ask, you know, what government is it that they're supporting? This is a government that controls more or less almost nothing of Mogadishu, of the capital city, and pretty much nothing outside this outside the capital. And there's been this transitional federal government experiment now has been going on since about 2004. There's been real international rhetorical commitment to it. But the reality on the ground in Somalia has been that that government has never been able to, in its two phases with President Yusuf and now President Sharif, has never been able to take control of significant amounts of territory.
And that was Roger Middleton, Africa specialist with Chatham House. Our main story today is the intrigue in Washington surrounding the disappearance and reappearance of the Iranian scientist Shahram Amiri. But for many Iranians, of more pressing concern is the weak state of the economy. State workers have just had 2 days off, apparently to help save electricity. And Tehran's Grand Bazaar, a normally bustling labyrinth of shops and stalls, has also been closed. Well, the shops have opened again today after the electricity shortage, and before that, a 4-day strike by the merchants who work there, a rare standoff between workers and the government. It was over government plans to raise sales taxes. Ali Pahlavan is a journalist in Tehran. What's the market like?
The bazaar is a very historical market. It's very traditional. It's more than 10 kilometers long. It has many, many different corridors. And it's not just a bazaar for trade. It's many financiers and banks are located there, many different sorts of trades and business and, mercantile activities goes on there.
So it's quite something if it shuts down for 4 days. Why did they close?
The bazaaris have changed. 31 years ago, before the Islamic Revolution, the bazaaris were supportive of the clerics and Ayatollah Khomeini and their revolution that did win in 1979 against the monarchy. But the bazaaris have changed. The second and third generations are now running the bazaar, and they are more supportive of moderate, more reformist elements, which came to the streets and in the millions last year. And so the government, led by Mr. Ahmadinejad and the hardline clerics, were not that happy about the way the bazaar acted. So this may be some sort of a retribution against the Bazaaris. But, I mean, the taxes, which were overnight, were increased by 70% that were announced, so the Bazaar reacted very angrily. There's also another factor which many are talking about. The government is running a huge deficit, and they're short on money. They're looking for ways of finding new sources of revenue. And increasing sales taxes on the Bazaaris is one way.
And but that would cause real hardship, would it, to the people working in the bazaar and also to shoppers? Presumably you'd have to pay an awful lot more for goods.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. The economy is in recession, not just because of the Western-imposed or UN-imposed sanctions. There's just a lack of confidence since last year's elections, which was quite controversial, and it was quite a shock to the economy, the society, and to the people. So it has had a domino effect on many different sectors of the economy.
Is the government worried about the bazaar and the bazaaris being a sort of an outlet for opposition, that they could become a sort of a hotbed for opposition?
Well, you know, the government reacts to everything that goes on in society. So we don't really know whether they're worried or not, but they react strongly to everything that goes on in society. But the bazaar is not what it used to be as far as the power that it had during the time of the Shah, when it went on a strike and it paralyzed the country, together with the NIOC, the National Iranian Oil Company workers that went on strike. That was the death knell for the monarchy. But the center, the power, the economic realities in Iran have changed, and the bazaar has lost some of its grandeur and some of its power, but still is influential, I would say.
That's Iranian journalist Ali Pahlavan speaking to me from Tehran. We'll have a potent mixture of politics and sport now, because the Milwaukee Brewers pitcher, Yovani Gallardo, has said that even if he's picked, he won't play in next year's Major League Baseball All-Star Game in Arizona. He says it's because of a controversial new immigration law in the state. The law, which is going to take effect at the end of this month, makes it a crime to be in the state without immigration papers. Well, Todd Ant is sports journalist with ABC News. He joins us now. And Todd, what has Gallardo been saying about this?
Well, you know, this is really the first time there's talk of a boycott. He doesn't agree with this law. The law allows police to pull you over or ask questions and check your papers, and it gives them full reign to do whatever they want in that regard. So he's saying that if I'm picked to the All-Star game next year, which is going to be held in Arizona, in Phoenix, it's rotated every year, he's not going to come. And also Kansas City Royals pitcher Joaquim Soria also said that he would stay away. And other Latino players have said they would do the same. But then, you know, they got other players that are not quite sure what they're going to do if it gets to that point.
Is it mostly Latino players at the moment who are objecting?
Yeah, absolutely. The Latino players are the ones that feel that this law is wrong. This isn't the first time that American sports teams have gotten involved in this. The Phoenix Suns, obviously, they play in Arizona. They had a little minor protest by putting Los Suns on the front of their uniforms. I wouldn't call it a protest, but just a little something from them saying that they were unhappy with the laws.
What is the significance of the All-Star game? How does that work?
Well, the All-Star game, it's baseball's what they call the Midsummer Classic. It's a break in between the season. The top players for the first half of the season are picked by the fans, and some are picked by the managers as well. And it's just it's sort of a wonderful festival, if you will, in the middle of the summer. It certainly is a very special sort of a reward for the players for playing well to be on an All-Star team. And like I said, if you're a city, you'd love to have the All-Star game come to your city. It generates a lot of money for that city, and it's a very prestigious thing to be a part of. But if they feel that strongly about it, I think there would be some Latino players that would agree to boycott, but I can bet that there would be some others that don't want to get involved. It's a political thing, and this is sports, and they would stay away.
Well, that could get quite tricky, couldn't it? Because presumably Arizona is going to be trying very hard to woo them and keep them on side, but you could end up with an all-star team that isn't all-stars at all.
Well, you'd get a lot of white and black players, but not too many Latino, and there's also a lot of Asian players that are being picked to All-Star games. But the Latinos make up a good percentage of Major League Baseball. So, it's a situation that I think the state doesn't want to get involved in. But by the way, I just want to tell you, Claire, this isn't the first time that the state has gotten involved in something like this. They did not recognize Martin Luther King's birthday as a holiday, and the National Football League did not award them a Super Bowl, which is huge. That generates a huge amount of money for cities.
That was back in the 1990s, wasn't it?
Yeah, in the early 90s. But they eventually came around, they did it, and then they got a Super Bowl in 96. So It just depends. I don't know how much pressure these Latino players could put on a city to change.
I just want to ask you, George, before we go, just very quickly, there is another story breaking on your side of the Atlantic right now. Unconfirmed reports that the owner of the New York Yankees, George Steinbrenner, has had a serious heart attack. Can you tell us anything about that just very quickly?
Yeah, you know, apparently, he lives in Tampa. He was taken to, he's been hospitalized in Tampa with multiple reports saying that he has had a massive heart attack and that he's in critical condition. Just turned 80 on July 4th. Owner of the New York Yankees, one of the most controversial owners in all of American sports, and it'd be very sad if he were to pass.
Todd Ant, thank you very much indeed. Todd Ant, their sports journalist with ABC News in the US. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. A reminder of today's main news stories. Pakistan has announced that a missing Iranian nuclear scientist, who Tehran says was kidnapped by the CIA, has turned up at the Iranian interest section of Pakistan's embassy in Washington. And the French Parliament is voting today for the first time on laws to ban women from wearing the full face veil in public. Earlier on NewsHour, we heard from one French woman who felt that wearing her burqa did not affect her sense of national identity.
It's not about how you dress. We're not robots. For instance, when I watch a football match, my heart supports France. That's what being French means. When France does something good, I'm happy and proud. But when I see this debate, I'm very unhappy. Being French, national identity is feeling at one with your country.
And one other headline, the first seven of a group of more than 50 Cuban political prisoners released on Monday has arrived in exile in Spain. Now, in the past couple of hours, the Afghan president Hamid Karzai has apologised to Britain after an Afghan soldier killed three British soldiers in Afghanistan in what's believed to have been a deliberate attack. It happened in Helmand province, and the British Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, has just issued this statement.
The soldiers were killed in a suspected premeditated attack by a member of the Afghan National Army using a combination of weapons. This is a despicable and cowardly act, and my thoughts and prayers go out to the family and friends of those who have lost their lives. Training and development of the Afghan National Security Forces is vital to the international security mission in Afghanistan, and today's events will not undermine the real progress we continue to make. British and ISAF forces are working shoulder to shoulder with the Afghans, and will continue to do so undeterred.
Well, that was the British Defence Secretary Liam Fox. With me now is the BBC Defence and Security Correspondent Nick Childs. Nick, can you tell us anything more about the incident? Are there any details?
Details are still patchy, and clearly the authorities are doing their best to put an investigation together right now. What appears to have happened is that this was at a checkpoint. Liam Fox, the Defence Secretary, said there, an Afghan soldier opened fire with a combination of weapons, we believe a rocket-propelled grenade and firearms, as well as killing three British soldiers. Apparently a number have also been injured. The soldier has disappeared for now. Clearly there's a hunt on for him. So although the suspicion is that this was premeditated, what isn't clear yet is what the motivations were. Was this political? Was this a more private, personal thing, or what?
It makes me think of something else that happened very similar along these lines, where there has been an Afghan attack on foreign forces in Afghanistan. It's not the first time, is it?
No, indeed. It's not the first time for the British. There was one only a few months ago where five British troops were killed by an Afghan policeman, and others also involving Americans. It's clearly part of the fact that this is a sensitive issue, that you've had that President Karzai and the new US and NATO commander, General David Petraeus, rushing out essentially with condolences because the Afghan training, mentoring, cooperation part of the military mission is perhaps the most important. It is essentially the coalition's exit strategy. It is vital, but at the same time there is an acknowledgement that it does carry risks.
It does show the problems that there are, doesn't it? And presumably they can't just vet every single Afghan soldier or policeman and try and work out what his future motives or his attitudes might be. That would just be impossible because they're trying to train thousands, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. They do go through a vetting process. Requirement for government identifications from vouching from local officials, but that's by no means foolproof. what NATO commanders are saying and officials are saying, though, is that tragic though this is, it is a relatively isolated set of incidents so far in the context of, as you say, over 230,000 Afghan forces that have now been trained, and a lot of work is going on that is working well. A lot of Afghans are sacrificing as well, but also I think there is a sense that whatever the dangers the ISAF foreign troops face, there are even more pressures on the local forces that are part of this process.
Nick Charles, thank you very much. Well, when the Taliban were ousted from government in Afghanistan in 2001, a lot was said there and abroad about how women would be freed from the years of extreme oppression. Well, now there are warnings that if the Afghan government pursues reconciliation and reintegration with the Taliban, as it is suggesting, women's rights will again be eroded. Human Rights Watch points out in a report that in areas under the Taliban, women suffer intimidation, violence, and even death threats. And the report says safeguarding their rights must be a priority in any talks. Wajmah Frog is an Afghan human rights activist. Just how much did change for women when the Taliban were pushed out of power?
There has been some positive achievements in terms of how women have really made as an attempt to be part of the social life. For example, within the parliament. The parliament, 27% of quota is a huge achievement. We never had this number of women in the parliament. And it's not only about the number, but also like these women in the parliament are very influential. But what happened in the past 4 or 5 years, the situation kind of really has become an insurgency. And in that situation, it's only because the U.S. government and also the international community's approach to Afghanistan has been really counterinsurgency. In counterinsurgency, women's rights, social development seems to have no value unless it has to do something with winning hearts and minds.
Explain that to me. When you say it has no value, you mean now the emphasis is on fighting the insurgency, not on promoting women's rights?
It was never actually on promoting women's rights, but what was at least convincing for us that there was some sort of international pressure on the government of Afghanistan to address its social issues. But after this coin, the counterinsurgency, has taken primacy over the institutional building, over state building, the situation has really kind of deteriorated.
But this is precisely why a lot of people are now suggesting that the best thing to do would be to talk to the Taliban about trying to reintegrate them in order to end the insurgency. Would that be a good idea?
When the government of Afghanistan and its international allies are talking about reconciliation, in such a reconciliation, you need to have a national agenda. But here, reconciliation is talks to the Taliban. I do not oppose talks to the Taliban, but I oppose this whole reconciliation plan, which has really reduced to a political settlement.
Well, what about then if women's rights were part of the discussion? If in order to be reconciled or brought into the government to share power in some way, they had to agree that girls should go to school, something that didn't happen under the Taliban, and that women's rights should be protected. Could that work?
I actually don't buy into this idea. I have been told about this many times. A lot of other high officials have been telling us that we will make sure that women's rights are not sacrificed. See, how can you believe that the same people who actually ruled with a certain agenda, with a certain belief, how can they be open to any sort of changes? This, even especially in the current situation now, you hear them that they are saying, we are winning. Why should we even talk to the international community or talk to the government of Afghanistan? And even look at the examples of the provinces or the districts which are under their control. Do you know that, for example, in the districts of Musa Qala, has any woman or girl being able to go to school? No.
How then do you improve women's rights? If you say that the emphasis now on counterinsurgency means that it's very difficult for women, that their needs and their rights are being ignored. If you talk to the Taliban, their needs and their rights will be ignored. Well, then how do you put women's rights on the agenda and protect them?
I think most importantly, we need this reconciliation plan, which should take a broader shape. We need to talk to the whole country, other ethnicities. That's one way of actually decreasing the influence of one militant group. So maybe if other ethnicities are also part of a talks, then it's more room for women to be part of that process. That's one thing. But the other thing is that Afghanistan needs to build its institution. The state has to be built. Unless we do not not establish trust of the common Afghan in the state, we will continue switching sides. This is what we Afghans have been doing in all the past 30 years. Whoever gives us a temporary shelter, a support, a service, we switch to them. It's because that we never knew what does a government mean in terms of what does a central, strong central government that can provide security and conflict-free life.
That's Afghan human rights activist Wajma Frog. And that's it from us for now. Thanks very much for joining us, from me, Claire Balderson, and from the rest of the team. Goodbye.